This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G. here along with Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good, good. How about yourself?
Doing pretty good. Just have a little of an announcement to make. So just for any listeners that are listening and maybe they can't call in during normal times of the show, we now have a manned voicemail box if you want to call and ask a question. I've been getting a couple of voicemails from people, and so we will be adding them to a segment of the show coming up. But the number to call and leave a message, make a comment, maybe, you know, if you have a story to share, the number is 714-900-2601. So anybody who can't call during this time, feel free to leave a message there, and then we can get to a question that way. And the other announcement is, so Dr. Lyle, you and I started the show about 3 years ago, since that time, we've been having a good time. This garage operation has been, you know, chugging along. We've been having a good time. And, you know, I've really felt like I'm going to college again, and you're my teacher. You're my professor. So after, you know, 1 hour a week and whatever time we spend discussing other topics afterwards, it turns out that other people have been enjoying this, and our listeners especially have contributed to this. All that is coming to is that we just hit a huge milestone for the show, and that is the all-time listens have reached 1 million. So it's incredible. We want to really thank our listeners for sticking in there with us, even despite some of the audio issues, and enjoying listening, sending in the questions, keeping the show going that way, and participating, giving us phone, sending us questions, stories, updates, and for the live callers as well. So Dr. Lyle, I mean, this is incredible. 1 million listens. Didn't think it was possible.
That is pretty cool. That's for truly a garage band to have people, you know, find value in this is just it's a really cool thing. I'm really happy to hear that.
And as I was talking with Dr. Lyle before the show, is that I guess this is what we would call pseudo esteem, where we're searching for these listens and the likes. And I posted this on our Fans of the Beat Your Genes Facebook group, a lot of positive feedback there. So Dr. Lyle, are we allowed to earn pseudo esteem this way?
Yeah, the pseudo esteem would be us bragging about it to a third party who didn't know anything about what we do. And just in order to intimidate and entice them to think that they were missing out. So yeah, that's fair, because it would be good for them if we were able to be successful. All right.
All right. Fantastic. Well, we've got a couple of great questions from some of our long-time listeners. But before we get to the question, we're going to go over an article that I was reading in the Evolutionary Psychology Journal, which is a free source, free journal for evolutionary psychology articles. Pretty fascinating things here. But the article is called Face Value and Cheap Talk: How Smiles Can Increase or Decrease the Credibility of Our Words. The primary author is Dr. Lawrence Ian Reed. The other author is Rachel Stratton and Jessica Rambies, and they are from New York University. So the study was about facial expressions. Now, they say that facial expressions with humans are usually taken at face value. The reason why is it comes from the difficulty in voluntarily controlling them. And this is Darwin coined this, the inhibition hypothesis. And so research had tested the inhibition hypothesis and found that people can actually voluntarily control their facial expressions. However, those expressions often activate other facial expressions, making it very difficult to control an entire entire mode of thinking with just one facial expressions. So one example of this are what's called the Duchenne smile, which is the term for a normal smile that not only raises the corners of the mouth like a normal smile, but also raises the cheeks and forms the wrinkles around the eyes. They call it smiling with the eyes, or smizing is the slang term for it. So in this particular study, participants were, they viewed a partner who displayed either a neutral expression, a non-Duchenne smile, so like a fake smile, and a Duchenne smile, and a, or a controlled smile. And a controlled smile would be in which the mouth forms a smile, but the facial muscle counteracts the upward pull of the lip corners, essentially controlling the smile. It's usually used when you're embarrassed and you smile and you kind of control the smile. So these participants were instructed to assess the credibility of a written statement when they were paired with one of the facial expressions, and then compare that result to the neutral expression. So the hypothesis in the study was that those participants who viewed the Duchenne smile would assess more credibility to the statement, and that those viewing the non-Duchenne smile would pick up on the voluntary attempt to manipulate and therefore would assign less credibility to the statement. This was done in two different experiments. The first experiment, they split up the participants. There was 143 males, 133 females, into three equal groups. The results were as follows. The Duchenne smiles increased the credibility of a written statement, while controlled smiles decreased the credibility, which was what the hypothesis was. In experiment two, obviously, because this was an experiment, they had to fake the Duchenne smile and they had to fake the fake smile. So they were trying to figure out if this holds true for genuine facial, genuine Duchenne smiles. So they set up the experiment where they could, what they spontaneously emit these expressions. So they would say certain phrases that were known to cause these expressions. And it turns out that just like experiment one, the data supports the signaling hypothesis, the credible signaling hypothesis. In comparison to neutral expressions, Duchenne smiles increased the credibility of accompanying statements, while the controlled smiles decreased the credibility. This suggests that the effects of these smiles remain even when the expressions are spontaneously emitted.
And don't think the chicks can't see it.
Practical purposes.
This is actually interesting for, you know, a thousand reasons, but the this is why it's hard to, in many instances, it's hard to fake it if you're confident, or hard to fake it sort of about who it is that you are. And you can get over on some people some of the time, but people can sniff you out, and they can tell when you're, you know, when you're selling BS, and they're reading all these little cues. This is really, this is a tiny little piece of a much, much wider discussion that is the fundamental basis of evolutionary psychology. And so I'm just going to go off for a few minutes on this.
We love that. Keep going.
Good. I was on a plane with nothing to do, and the internet didn't work, and I happened to have downloaded on my phone an interview with Lita Cosmides. And so I was listening to her, and it wasn't anything that I didn't know, but it was interesting to hear her talk about culture and the because she was sort of bashing the way that normal anthropologists and sociologists think about culture. And what she was explaining was that there isn't any such thing as quote culture. What all you're really observing is you're observing the activation of latent neural circuits that were built by evolution. And so all that happens in a given location, there tends to be the similar activation of the same neural circuits. So for example, if you go up to Alaska, you're going to find a lot of people wearing a lot of clothing and worried about the weather and the cold. If you go to Los Angeles, they're not going to be wearing as many coats. And so you could call that culture, which God knows what that means. But what you're really observing is the activation of temperature regulation circuitry and associated behaviors that would be that would be instinctual to the organism. And in the same way, so if you look at the behavior of any entity, what you're watching is you're watching the environmental inputs activate latent neural circuits and then cause them to fire, and then the person has a behavior and experience. So you could be petting your cat, and then you take out a shoestring and wiggle it around, and now you activate the circuit, a predatory circuit in the cat. Whereas if you were petting a rabbit and you did that, it wouldn't have the same effect. And so it's going to turn out that in different areas of the world, you're going to have, for example, similar topography, similar geographical situations. In other words, foodstuffs, food availability, population densities, all kinds of things that are going to be similar. So one individual to the next is going to be facing a great many of the same similar environmental inputs, which is going to cause a behavior that's going to be similar in those people and more similar in those people than they would be in some people somewhere else. And so that culture is going to look different. Now, one of the things that Cosmides does not talk about, but it's been talked about by Nicholas Wade, is that we can even go further than that. And that is that in specific areas of the world, certain personality characteristics are more typical of a given set of people in a given region. Often also as a result of natural selection or sexual selection, as a result of the idiosyncratic characteristics of that particular social or physical ecology over the last thousands of years. So in a given area, there could be highly conscientious, shy people. And in other areas of the world, they might be loud and noisy and more sexually bold. Those then also are impacting, those become part of the set of inputs that are impacting everybody else in that local arena, and therefore influencing the psychological and behavioral experiences that those people are going to have. And we might sit back and call that culture. And you can legitimately call it culture and legitimately study it. But when people tend to think of culture, they tend to think of some ether or special rules that are absorbed by an individual as a result of the surroundings that they find themselves in and that they grow up in. And that would be an incorrect way of understanding what you're actually looking at. The social actions that they're, if you think about emotional and behavioral processes are of an individual, they are not taking place in multiple brains. It's only taking place in one brain at a time. And so if a whole bunch of brains are having a whole bunch of similar experiences, it's because a whole bunch of brains are looking at the very similar inputs. So i.e. a whole bunch of Eskimos are freaking freezing so they can put their coats on, okay? Or a whole bunch of people in Panama take their shirts off because the sun came out. So therefore, when we really look at human nature, why people behave the way they do, we're going to find is what Cosmides is trying to exhort the social sciences to understand, is that if you're going to study and understand human nature, you have to understand that there's all these tiny little fascinating neural circuits that are sitting inside the organism, and they're latent, and they only come out under certain conditions. This study is a beautiful example of this, that sitting in human nature is a suspicion that if somebody fakes a smile with voluntary action, you can get over on some of the people some of the time. That's why people use those voluntary actions. However, it's going to turn out that often they will be caught. Okay. And because it turns out that what we have is we have manipulation, and then we have defenses against manipulation. And the defense against the manipulation is going to be to look closely at whether their eyes are crinkling and their cheeks are lifting. And if they're not, don't trust them. Okay, they could very likely be intentionally deceiving you. And that is nothing, incidentally, that like this is not something that is learned. My parents never sat and said, look, watch their faces. Okay, don't trust them unless their eyes crinkle up. There's not a chance in hell that that's true. This is the discovery of decision rules for having activating defensive mechanisms inside the inference making machinery. Do I trust what they say or not trust what they say? The answer is, if they're neutral, there's some baseline credibility to whatever it is. If it turns out that they're smiling and crinkling, then I believe that what they're saying has more credibility. And if they're forcing a smile, it has less. These are fascinating aspects of the extraordinarily complex web of instincts that makes up human nature. So thanks for bringing this to our attention, Nate. It's a beautiful little jewel that is now sitting in the literature.
That's fantastic. And just to further validate what you just said is, in this study, in the introduction, they talk about this exact phenomenon, which is that across conditions, they found that someone can fake an expression, and it was about 40% of people could fake an expression, but 100% of the people could not prevent another expression of their face to also occur simultaneously when they were faking it.
Right.
And so they could do it, but they couldn't control every single facial expression, which is fascinating.
Yeah, you know, it turns out that I have a favorite all-time TV show. And it used to be that my favorite all-time TV show was the original Star Trek. And so then when I watched The Next Generation, I was like, you know, I just can't get into the people. And then I did get into the people, and then that became my favorite all-time show because the writing is better and everything's better about it. It's just really a fabulous series. And so then when I ran out of that one, I was looking around and a friend told me, oh, you should watch this thing called The Mentalist, starring Simon Baker. And it's about some guy I'm thinking, oh God, you know, I'm not going to be interested in something called The Mentalist about a guy that is tricky with the mind. Well, it's fabulous. It's just unbelievably good. And this is precisely what the major thrust is of the entire series, is that Baker plays a person who is exceptionally good at reading facial cues. And it's really very believable. And it's believable, number one, because it's true. And we intuitively know that people leak a lot of stuff on the faces. And what's really cool is to watch how his character, you know, basically flusters people and surprises them in ways that make them have facial expressions that catch them off guard, and they reveal what their motivations are. And he's able to pick it up. So it's just incredible writing, beautiful acting, and it's playing out exactly what it is that we're talking about here in this study.
Fantastic. Well, this leads beautifully into our very first question from a longtime listener.
All right.
And this is on the topic of the sucker triad, which is the combination of intelligence, agreeability, and high conscientiousness. And so, dear Dr. Lyle, on the topic of the sucker triad and shifting an interaction from adult to parent-child, I was wondering if people use this as a baiting technique for mating. I would think that if a woman does this to a man, it might trip some Stone Age feelings in the man of wanting to prove or show off their skills. I'm thinking of the classic scenario where a woman plays helpless and it then gives the man a chance to display his fitness indicators. But I'm also wondering what's actually at play there. I've also seen situations where helpless men have, for lack of a better term, conned women into taking care of them. So I'm wondering if there is some benefit to this on the part of the person who's being taken advantage of. Maybe they get esteem from knowing they are providing. Or are they just guilt tripped into it because they are a sucker? Or am I possibly conflating a few different phenomena?
Now, this is really good. This is a fantastic question. And I think that what the person's speculating on, they're looking at this is where life gets tricky in evolutionary psychology, and other ways of looking at psychology can get frustrated because there's a lot to learn, and you have to grasp the underlying logic that says, listen, we're not talking about, quote, everything's genes or, quote, nothing's environment. What we're talking about is an unbelievably sensitive machine that's like the most complicated jukebox you ever saw. And the jukebox says if K7 is activated and J16 is activated and P3 is activated, then activate circuit Z7. Okay? But if any of those other three is different, then we're not going to activate Z7. So let's talk about some of the possibilities. So this person's mentioning a few, but you could have, for example, the helpless action or helpless display or communication activates parental altruism, and therefore it benefits the quote helpless person by sucking time and energy out of that out of the helper. But it's also a display for the giver, which the person mentions. However, it's also a signal of interest in the relationship from the standpoint of the giver being able to display interest in the relationship. They're willing to invest time and energy. So there's an additional possible signal there. Strangely enough, there's a reciprocal signal that if you receive aid from somebody, you may be willing to be in a relationship with them, because we are beginning the activation of a reciprocal altruistic dyad. And therefore, if you are insuring me, then I should be willing to insure you. And so it could actually be a signal that I am interested in you if I allow you to help me. Okay? So, unlike my favorite all-time character in a movie is Jack Nicholson in As Good As It Gets.
What a crack up that guy was.
Don't touch. Okay. No, don't. No, I don't need any help. Okay. I.e., if I don't need any help, isn't that a good thing? I don't want to be in debt. All right. So now, on the other hand, the helpless person, by playing helpless, they get to read a signal, which is how much am I liked? And they get to see how eager the person is or willing they are to be helpful. So this is a sign. It's a way of assessing the utility of an insurance policy by, for example, making a claim early. So if you bought an insurance policy from a company that you're not so sure is worth it, a good thing to do would be to file a claim early that has some legitimacy and see if they pay it. Okay, and if they don't pay it, then hey, wait a minute. I'll be damned if I'm going to go in and pay a lot of money for an insurance policy that I'm counting on bailing me out of big trouble later. So this would be a way to test market whether or not the person is a decent insurance policy. So this would be a sort of a disagreeable person's tactic. So I believe that people that would pull a stunt like this, play helpless and suck people's energy out and sort of play this sort of deeply manipulative type of a strategy, are probably on average more disagreeable than the average human. I would expect that would be true. And that's a nice doctoral dissertation for somebody as they would work their way through that web, because I'm sure that's exactly how that works.
Fascinating question, fascinating answer. I've often wondered, as you say, that and Jack Nicholson's character doesn't want to have any debts. And perhaps there's a, you know, social theory optimal to this, which is, you know, just like the United States has the highest debt of the world, but the highest status of the world, we infer that, you know, part of gaining high status strategy in a village would include amassing a lot of Stone Age debt.
Interesting. Let's think about that. Having a lot of debt actually puts you in an interesting negotiating position with people. And that is that you can continue to essentially make trades and potentially make trades where you are in the advantage. In other words, where you're giving 49% but taking 51%. And the individual on the other side would be possibly foolish to not go along with this additional trade that looks like a legitimate trade with a slightly legit, you know, a slight disagreement about the value for value. But if they refused, then you could basically say, hey, you know, what you're holding over their head is the possible reneging on your debt. And so this is why it's not the worst thing in the world for a country, particularly with the United States, with the massive military and economic resources that we have. It's not a bad thing to be in a lot of international debt because what are they going to do? we can push them around and potentially exploit them by threatening to renege on the debt in principle, and they're on the other side. They really don't have a choice. They have to, as long as we are not egregiously unreasonable in the trades that we are proposing, we can use that debt to our advantage and make them essentially force them into a tougher negotiating situation as a result of that debt. So it's another aspect to how that would work.
Mm-hmm. And now, as far as rather than financial debt, could it be like Stone Age money, mm-hmm. like insurance, i.e. people have done favors for you, you know, helped you out of the yes. snake hole and all that kind of thing?
Correct. That's right. Same thing. So it's possible that you, in theory, you could be in a lot of debt, and you could still, they could not want to have a fight with you over what's fair in a given situation, because if you did, the fight could, you could be using that as justification to essentially renege on your debt. So same principle is involved here, and this all gets into why we don't want to make deals with disagreeable people. You know, this is precisely why that is. Because, you know, in a multitude of ways, disagreeable people are, by definition, they are trouble when it comes to exchanges and the cataloging of debts and credits. And so, I mean, obviously debts and credits are subject to a sort of renegotiation, contextual process, everything else under the sun. But just in general, they are. But it's particularly difficult, they're particularly problematic when the person on the other side of a debt arrangement is, you know, if anybody in there is disagreeable, that situation is potentially loaded. So careful who you get into bed with, because if you sleep with big dogs, you're going to wind up with big fleas.
I love your idioms.
All right. Let's
All
go
right.
on.
All right, so we have a caller waiting on hold. So caller, please be patient. Really appreciate you staying on hold. We're going to answer one more question, and then we're going to get to you. So Dr. Lyle, this is from our fans in Australia who go on long road trips and love listening to the show. So really appreciate listening from all the way in Australia. Dr. Lyle, I recently read an article about negative emotions being contagious. What's your view on this? Anecdotally, it seems to be true for me. For example, I have a friend at work who does not like the workplace and is constantly unhappy and negative. I find that if I spend too much time with her, it rubs off on me and I feel unsettled, even though work on the whole is fine for me. Mm-hmm. Similarly, I have a friend who is buoyant and always laughing. When I spend time with her, I feel light and happy. Do you believe emotions are contagious?
Yes, they are. And let's talk about why this is. That you will reverberate cues that indicate the value relations in your environment. So you have what we're going to call independent method, but you also have computer checking capabilities that check what other people seem to be experiencing, and this would reduce the error variance in your own decision making. So an example that I've given before has been two women, a pair of eights are sitting in a bar, and in walks a male that is objectively a nine. However, in one of the girls' heads, he's an eight, and in the other girl's head, he's a 10. So let's suppose for the sake of argument that the two girls are actually honest with each other. They're very good friends. Now, the 1-8 that thinks he's a 10 is, you know, all giggly when she sees this guy and turns to her friend and says, "Wow, what do you think?" Now, she's having an independent action. In other words, she's having an independent process that's going on inside of her head. So her independent method says, my neural circuits are getting hit by this stimuli, and it says that this is an exceptional specimen, and it's 20% more attractive than I am, and therefore I'm very interested in casual mating strategy. Okay. So she is about to be highly susceptible to casual mating strategy because her Stone Age brain is inferring that the delta between her and the male's gene quality is substantial enough that this is worth doing. It's worth raising the kid alone. That's the machinery and that's the inferences that it's making. Now, however, she does something interesting, and that is she turns to her friend who she trusts and says, "What do you think of him? Wow." And her friend turns and says, "He's okay." Now, what you're going to find is you're going to find a deflation inside of her nervous system. Okay, she will literally feel deflated and a little bit depressed if we looked inside the nervous system. There's a disappointment there. Okay, now she looks back at the guy and her own independent circuits say, "Wow, it's pretty good." But she's got some additional circuits now that are saying, definitely not worth casual mating strategy. Now, we, like I said, we're going to ignore all of the history of these girls, but let's suppose for the sake of principle that the two of them have had many such situations and her friend is highly credible. So when they agree and they're both giggly. And when they both, when they don't agree, they're like, "Hey, you know, that they're open and honest. They're not trying to game each other in a situation." All right. So let's suppose that's the case. So now when she sees her friend, she sees her friend's reaction. And now what her brain does, it says, well, what we're attempting to do is we're attempting to make the best deal for our genetics because that's how we're built. We're built as a gene copying machine. Now, under conditions where a male is 20% objectively superior to me, I would be willing to raise the kid alone. But I am finding now that it appears that the male may only be 10% objectively superior to me because my estimate says 20 and my friend's estimate says 0. So the truth is probably somewhere in between my independent assessment and my friend's assessment. So I have to attenuate the extremities by taking a mean of the two. And as a result, I feel somewhat deflated and not as motivated. Okay, so that will now influence. So now we're finding our emotions, quote, contagious. That's a, you know, we could say contagious, but what we're really seeing here is that we're seeing the two sources of inputs that are coming in and influencing a person's integrated experience. And that is that the independent assessment versus a computer checking method where you check what other people are thinking so that you can make sure that your own independent assessment is not an outlier. That is a very smart, incredible piece of machinery that sits inside of humans. Okay. So it's
fascinating
because the Spice Girls
actually had this figured out in a song in the 90s called "If You Want to Be My Lover, You Got to Get the Approval of My Friends." So,
yeah, there you go. Okay. So this is all about, quote, meet the parents and all this kind of stuff. There's a, when you think about meeting the parents, it's actually, there's all kinds of stuff going on there. There's so many different agendas. There, all instinctual agendas, including looking at the gene quality of the gene pool because the person you're with is only one exemplar, okay, of the gene pool. So, you know, I've met your sisters, Nate. They're a little above you. So just as,
don't worry, they know.
In case anybody wants to know, Nate G is a nice looking young doctor, but his sisters, he's actually on the low side of his own pretty fancy gene pool. So this is how this is going to work, that we're going to use independent other people's checking mechanisms to essentially reduce error variance. So therefore, emotional processes are definitely contagious, as are, of course, behavioral processes, which emotional processes are behavioral because you can see the expressions of emotions in the muscular contractions of an individual's body. but the actual actions that they then take as a result, the emotions are essentially cues as to the value judgments that the brain has engineered. And therefore, the emotions are precursors, or they are forerunners of what behavior you're about to see. Okay? So in the case of our girl in the bar, now she had excitement that wanted to close the distance between herself and the theoretical 10. And now she just got a big breaking force, came in from a different area of the brain, a computer checking circuit that said, wait a minute, put your foot on the brake. Okay. And now we're going to have to go back and circle around this whole thing again, because a 9 is not necessarily the delta between her 8 and his probable 9 is now a kid that's an 8.5. And therefore that's not fancy enough to raise a loan. So that's why we're going to find that her behavior is likely to have a significant attenuation of its motivation. So this is why emotions are contagious, as well as behavior. So there's been many studies in the history of psychology that have shown behaviors to be contagions. For example, divorce is a contagion. So one member of a social group gets a divorce, and then suddenly you will find other members will start to get divorces. Starting smoking, stopping smoking, all kinds of things have been shown to have contagious aspects to them. So contagion is an interesting word to use, but it can start to look mysterious and ethereal and et cetera. But the truth is what it actually is it's computer checking that results in a modification of our own individual personal assessment of the value proposition in a given situation. This is why they use shills, at a carnival. So we have somebody saying, "Oh, wow, that looks really cool." And the human brain goes, "Huh, somebody thinks it's really cool. I was only thinking it was sort of cool, and now I think it's more cool." And my brain jumps to the midline between that person's assessment and my own. Okay? And so this is the nature of, quote, contagion in human psychology.
Would you say that this is why there are laugh tracks for sitcoms when people are sitting in their living rooms?
There's no question. That's exactly what it is. And I've noticed many times as a speaker that you will feel like, quote, a crowd has a vibe. So other speakers and I will talk about this afterwards, where we'll speak to a group and we'll either say, "Wow, great crowd," or it's like, "Wow, they're flat." Okay. And so, and part of the extremes of this isn't because the means of those individual groups are so far apart. They probably are not that far apart. But all that it takes is a certain level to either activate a contagious process or not. And if you can activate the contagious process, then suddenly everybody's having a great time. If you cannot activate the contagious process, then it isn't. So that's part of how humans work as little social animals.
It's fascinating you said that. I always had an inkling that that might be true, and that it might be related to how spaced apart the chairs are when people are together in the crowd.
Yes, so. All kinds of things. That's why if you ever run a seminar, you always want to have it wall to wall with the people in there, okay? You don't want 100 people in a room with 200. You want 100 people in a room that can hold 90, and you want the fire marshal to not know about it, okay? So you want to have it crammed in there, and you'll have the greatest amount of social contagion to those processes. So that's exactly how you do it.
Fascinating. All right, we're going to welcome our caller who's calling. Caller, thank you so much for staying on hold for the show. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hello?
Oh, hello. Yes.
Hey, Nate and Dr. Lyle, this is Rob from USA.
Hey,
Rob. Wait a second.
Welcome back,
is it Rob. Okay, Rob.
Yes.
And you're from the USA. All right, very cool. What's going on, Rob? What's happening?
Hey, Nate and everyone else under the sun, don't you wish they'd hurry up and invent the technology where you can download people's brains, into your app and your phone, so we can just download Dr. Lyle's brain right into our phone so we could ask a question whenever we wanted to? I mean, that would just be great. thing right there.
We'll make an AI robot one day.
There you go. That's all right. Good plan.
I'm not holding my breath for that. But anyway, I think I got two really good questions. Dr. Lyle, is there ever a time when it would make sense to not flood the circuits? And what I mean by that is, let's say, like, if you care about your relationship with the person, then that's going to be in that context. But if you don't care about your relationship with the person, then, you know, whoever it is, family, friend, trading partner, sexual mate, mm-hmm. whatever it is, if you don't care about the relationship, then you don't have to go out of your way to flood the circuits. But if you care about your relationship with the person, do you, and let's say you have a big fight and everything blows up and you don't talk for a couple months, but you know, it's itching you, you got to get back to it and you got to eventually going to resolve this. But if you're a disagreeable person, you come back, you don't want to come back. I'm not going to come back and kiss your ass essentially and flood the circuits. I want to be honest,
right,
say how I feel, and let's agree to disagree. And then we'll agree to disagree. And then whatever it is, we'll just be civil, but I'm not going to flood the circuits. For a disagreeable person, that's hard to just bite your tongue. I want to tell you how I feel, and then we'll disagree, and then we'll move on. You understand what I'm saying?
Sure. Yeah. The utility of flooding the circuit is that what we're trying to do is we're trying to establish several things. It could be extremely manipulative, and if you need it, it's good to know that it's there in principle. The other thing that's good about it is that it can actually be the reestablishment of the correct global cost benefit analysis that a person comes to a discussion with about the entire relationship. And so when we are arguing and when we have a dispute, there's sort of a point in the dispute where there's a conflict of interest, and the conflict of interest could be a difference of opinion about something important, about who's valuable in what way. In other words, disagreements that have any edge to them at all are all about status. So somebody is feeling slighted, but it could be the case that they're feeling slighted in a relatively narrow domain, but they're still pissed about it. And so the problem is that they could be pissed off enough about this that they're kind of not that the argument itself can start to push itself into a vicious cycle, and now the esteem hits become wider and wider, and the thing gets pretty negative and nasty. That's a typical pattern for people. Now, the problem then is that we need to reestablish a wider context of the person's value and the narrowness and specificity of the dispute about somebody's value. And so that's where flood the circuit comes in. So flood the circuit is actually done in its best possible way. It's actually accurate. In other words, these are the most discerning, most sophisticated insights that we can have about why we find another person valuable. And we feed them to that individual, not only with the attribute, but also anecdotes that support what it is that we're saying. And when we essentially feed these to the individual one after the next, and what it does is it starts establishing a wider context of why it is that we have a relationship in the first place, and reestablishes a framework from which we then can go in and say, yes, but in this specific area where we disagreed, you know, I'm still really pissed off. And this is where I disagree with you about how it is that you're seeing it, and this is how it is that I see it. Okay? And then from here, obviously, what sits along with flooding the circuit is crystal clear. So this is now where it is that now that everybody's calmed down and we flooded somebody's circuit, so we have reduced everybody's anxiety that they are in an exacerbation vicious cycle where we're going to take, you know, we're going to threaten each other and take down each other's status. And basically, and I will pillory your status in the village, because you are now making noises like you're going to come after mine. And so this is essentially status warfare, and that's a disaster. So we reverse field and unilaterally force this disagreement into a virtuous cycle. And so if we do this, then we make it possible then to come back to the source of conflict and then say, okay, I don't know what we're going to do with this, but this is how I think you see it, and this is how I see it, and this is where I disagree with you, okay? And am I seeing it the way, am I accurately reporting what it is that you're thinking? Now, very often under these circumstances, what's going to happen is people's positions will soften, because it turns out that usually if it's a friend of yours and you value them and they value you, you recognize that you did a standard human action, which is that the position you took was ignoring some of the truth that they were saying, and that their position was somewhat exaggerated and hostile, and your position became somewhat exaggerated and hostile. And so, you know, we wound up in a situation where everybody's playing status defense and getting aggressive. And so now we wind up in a vicious cycle that was the argument that threatens the relationship. So instead, what we do is the utility of flood the circuit and then moving to crystal clear is that now we find out that we don't have to play so aggressively and we don't have to be so nasty, and that we are safe, and we can actually find, we can see that our disagreements aren't necessarily in such bright contrast as it looked like that they were, that it's softer and that it's grayer. Okay, fair enough. So I've been through this many times. Whenever in any relationship, when somebody criticizes me, I immediately bristle and I've watched my neural circuits like argue and get defensive and then get aggressive towards them, et cetera, et cetera. Like this is, I watch these automated mechanisms. It's like, it's not my fault. It's my freaking ancestors put them in there. Okay. So they're interesting to watch. And then it becomes my task as a human that can hopefully beat my genes is to actually override that, back up, not act too impulsively, and then see whether or not I can think my way out of a potentially damaging situation. So that's how I look at this. Now, as I've described flood the circuit at other times, sometimes we're flooding the circuit and we can be doing it. We can be disingenuous. And the reason why we're doing is that we're in a serious position of weakness and we need to manipulate somebody. So it's useful to know that it's there, that card is on the table for you. Potentially that's a possible get out of jail card in a lot of situations, is to know that that's there. But in relationships that have a future and that you are not under any kind of intimidation or position of weakness, where it's as you're describing, and you recognize that the relationship may have limited overlap in your life, but you just assume it not be go on with a latent hostility, then there's nothing disingenuous about this process at all. And the flooding is a extremely useful tool. You don't have to do it like it's the most important person in the world, but the basic concept, you might only flood for 20 seconds, but the notion is that you do it well enough that you establish the wider context of where, of how it is that you value the individual, so that the area that we disagree is put in proper perspective, and therefore people can make much better decisions about how they manage that conflict of interest. Does that make sense?
And,
Yeah,
that makes a lot of sense. I'm going to go back and listen to that after this a bunch of times. But the other one, Dr. Lyle, real quick, was I was laughing recently when you talked about how you – I think you were talking about how you couldn't date a person who was too agreeable because she's going to be on the phone when you're out with her and some annoying old friend of hers is going to call up, and because she's so agreeable, she can't help herself and it's going to ruin your whole day with them. And I was laughing because I dated a girl who was a flight attendant. So she got a bunch of flight benefits, and they have people who work for the airlines. They have a whole list of their buddies, and she had like 10, 15 people on her list. And she was a very agreeable person, and I'm disagreeable, but our relationship was seeming to work. But this was one factor that kind of turned me off, where because she had people on her buddy list who would call her and to try and get discounted tickets and stuff. And on the outside, it's like, well, why should I care? But when I thought about it, I was like, well, wait a minute, you haven't seen this person in 3 years. When's the last time this person has even called you? Like, so it seemed to me these people were just using her, and it annoyed me. So my question is, Dr. Lau, why are people like us just disagreeable assholes? Why can't we just be okay with them doing that for people?
Because you're inferring that if resources became tight, resources are in principle always tight, because you're always trying to utilize all of your available resources in order to further your biological success. Now, in this case, we're not trying to turn those resources into the DNA molecule the way we were designed. We're just trying to turn those into enjoyable life processes. But any way you slice it, your resources are limited. And the more resources you have, the more possibility you have of turning your lifetime and energy into enjoyable processes. If this a partner is somebody who, in principle, is adding to your existence, and they bring with them both benefits, but they also bring liabilities. And so overall, there's still the process of the joint energies attempting to manufacture or activate out of our energy pool between us. We're trying to activate moods of happiness circuits inside of our two nervous systems. If she is going to be giving away a bunch of her time and energy and resources to third parties, and that she's very easily exploited by people who haven't talked to her and she hasn't seen them in 3 years, then you recognize that she's a leaky boat. Okay. She brings with her, no matter what it looks like today, any significant relationships brings with it the potential of liabilities. That's why the marriage vows, for example, say in sickness and in health and rich and poor. In other words, these are sort of deep, significant contracts, and they have potential significant liabilities. So therefore, the idea is that we want to be estimating what the overall CB is of the entire package that the individual brings. If they're very agreeable, the nice thing about it is that they're not fighting us, in the transactions where there's conflicts of interest of resources between the two of us. However, if they're overly agreeable, they can be giving away the store and out the back door when we're not looking. And so that's what you saw there. You're not just being a disagreeable asshole. You're actually, you might be, but the truth is that it would frustrate me as well if I looked at that situation. And I would see that the individual was being exploited, and that meant that they were pretty far from the middle of the bell curve when it came to the agreeable dimension, which is a liability. So as much of an asset as it would be for me personally between our two conflicts of interest, it is also a liability that she would be giving away resources that I would otherwise be able to claim and utilize. So that's why. It's got a totally rational response. And obviously, the more disagreeable the male is, the more frustrated he would be by this. But even a male that's right smack down the middle of the bell curve, even an agreeable male could wind up frustrated at a female who is just way too agreeable. So that's the dynamic that you were sensing, and that's what was frustrating you.
Makes sense.
Okay.
Rob, thank you very
much.
All right. The great questions.
Thank you, guys. Have a good night.
Very good. Thank you, Rob. Absolutely. Thanks for calling.
Thank you so much for the call. And for our newer listeners, if you want to listen more about flooding the circuits, the very first episode where Dr. Lyle went over this was episode 54, called Repairing a Strained Relationship. And it is a on-air session with a caller. And Dr. Lyle describes how to flood the circuits near the end of the episode. So listen to that if you want more information. CB stands for cost-benefit analysis. So we're welcoming a few new listeners. We've had a flood in the last 6 months or so. So Dr. Lyle, I think that's it for one evening. We had another caller on hold, but the call dropped. So Caller, feel free to call back next week and we'll take you.
Thanks
for listening, everybody. Dr. Lyle, thank you as always for this, you know, we're 168 episodes now. Great milestone.
Yeah.
So let's go another few more and keep going. I'm really enjoying this. I know the listeners are, and I hope you are too.
Fabulous. Having a great time, Nate. You're doing a terrific job.
Fantastic. Well, Dr. Lyle, we'll speak to you next week. Have a good night.
Cool.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.